This week on Making Contact.
What were my daughter's last words? How long was my father alive before you killed him? I mean, those are questions where we, you know, as a general audience, don't want to go near. We think that's really scary stuff. Why would you want to know the horror of those answers, you know? But the reality is that I've learned from victims that I've worked with is, you know what, there's nothing worse than their imagination.
After a murder, how can justice best be served for society and for the victim's family? Will an execution bring closure, as proponents of the death penalty sometimes contend? And how is the potential for closure affected if flaws, corruption, and malfeasance are involved when applying the death sentence? On this Prison Desk edition of Making Contact, we take a look at the death penalty, wrongful executions, and a couple of alternatives to death row. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. On June 11, 2001, Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, was executed by lethal injection. There was no doubt about his guilt. A confessed killer, McVeigh helped the guards strap him down on the gurney. He stared into a closed-circuit camera as the poison surged through his veins. It was a moment that many people who lost loved ones in the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building had been waiting for since that awful day, April 19, 1995. They were looking for retribution and a sense of closure. Mike Gray is author of The Death Game, Capital Punishment and the Luck of the Draw.
It is the one area where the death penalty proponents really do have an argument, because that argument is made by the victims' relatives themselves. I mean, they're saying, you know, like, I demand to see this retribution here. But the question of whether or not the death penalty will provide that closure is another problem altogether. And I cite the case of Timothy McVeigh as a classic example here. Bud Welch was the Texaco dealer, is the Texaco dealer in Oklahoma City, and his daughter died in the Oklahoma City bombing. And he was on his way down to have lunch with her that day. And she was according to Bud Welch's description, his daughter was a remarkable young woman indeed, beautiful from the photographs you can see, and very dedicated and working as a kind of a public servant, as a translator in the Social Security Administration, about to be married to an Air Force officer, you know, that kind of thing. It was tragic. And he was consumed with, as you can imagine, I mean, like, if Timothy McVeigh had fallen into Bud Welch's hands at that time, there would not have been a trial. There would have been nothing to discuss. And he was driving him. He was drinking heavily, and, you know, like, not eating, and health deteriorating, and consumed with rage and hatred. And one day he happened to catch sight of Timothy McVeigh's father on TV. And the old man was gardening, and somebody was trying to interview him, and he was trying to avoid the interviewer. And he glanced up at the camera and looked in the camera for just a brief instant. And Bud Welch looked at that, caught that, and he said he recognized the look. I know that look, that absolute bottomless agony. And he realized that he had to call this guy and, you know, somehow say, you know, I feel for you. And they met. And at that point, Bud Welch had closure. He no longer wanted Timothy McVeigh to be boiled in oil or to have his testicles ripped out through the top of his head or anything like that. He wanted him put in prison for the rest of his life so that he would have an opportunity to think about what he'd done from now on.
More than 200 people viewed McVeigh's execution via closed-circuit television in a tent specially erected for the victims' families.
230 people sat in there looking at Timothy McVeigh's face from closed-circuit television in the death chamber in Terre Haute. And what they were hoping for is this one guy said, whose mother had died after the front of the building blew off, his mother dropped four stories, you know, to her death, and she was terrified of heights. And this guy wanted McVeigh to feel that kind of terror in his final moments. Instead, what he saw was Timothy McVeigh hop up onto this death gurney, help the guards strap him in, acknowledge each person in the room in turn with a nod of the head, look directly into the camera, make a statement, no remorse, no, a soldier, warrior to the end, I did what I did, you know, whatever. And then they open the needles and he goes to sleep. And these people felt outraged, and you can understand why. And at that point, you know, like, of course, drawing and quartering or pressing to death with stones or burning at the stake begins to make a certain amount of sense. And you can understand why people would want that. But the myth of closure that the death penalty is supposed to bring turns out to be more myth than fact. Now, I'm sure there are some people that do get closure, and God bless them. And that's if the individual in question happened to be actually be guilty of the crime. That is where the death penalty is supposed to work. The things that we have to worry about are that latter point. And based on the research, I got to tell you, Philip, and this is just simply a gut level reaction. It's an old engineer, old airplane man, giving you gut level instinct just from listening to the sound of the engine. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I would venture that at least 10% of the people on death row tonight are innocent of the crime for which they're convicted.
In fact, through DNA testing alone, attorneys Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld in their Innocence Project have cleared 137 death row inmates as of early July 2003. Author Mike Gray says that what's perhaps more startling is that about 20% of those found innocent had signed false confessions. Take the case of the Death Row 10 in Chicago.
They actually were tortured at Area 2 headquarters by police officers under the command of a Lieutenant John Burge. And there's no doubt about this. Judge Milton Shadur, the U.S. federal judge in Chicago, said these crimes took place and these people were tortured and these confessions were tortured out of them at the hands of these police officers. They know this because one of the cases, there was a photograph taken, one of these guys, and this proved to be the key that unlocked that little horror story. When this guy, they brought him into the lockup to be incarcerated at Cook County Jail, and the head jailer there said to the cops who were bringing him in, I'm not accepting this guy until I take some pictures, because I don't want anybody accusing me of doing this damage on my watch. The guy looked obviously not in very good shape. And that photograph turned out, upon close examination, which years later fell into the hands of an attorney, and the group, the People's Law Office, it's called in Chicago, Flint Taylor and Jeff Haas, have been on the government's case all these years. And they got this case, and they looked at this photograph, and they found that there were vertical burn marks on the guy's chest that matched, like, looked like he'd been shoved against a radiator. And they found little marks on his earlobes that, when looked at under a magnifying glass, had the shape of an alligator's teeth. And so when they talked to this guy, he said, well, yes, they hooked electrodes to my ears and turned this hand crank generator. And he said, when that machine takes over, he said, you don't think about nothing. He said that he was handcuffed to rings on the wall on either side of this radiator, which was like chest high. And he said when they started turning the crank, he slammed into that radiator, you know, as a reaction. And he said, but that radiator, that was nothing. He said, I didn't even feel it. He said, what was going on in my head? It grinds and grinds and grinds and grinds and grinds and grinds and grinds. He said, you don't think about nothing else. He said, all my teeth was loose behind that. Think about clenching your jaw tight enough to loosen your teeth. Okay? I mean, at that point, if they offer you an opportunity to confess, I think you'd probably go for anything. So that was what was going on at Area 2 headquarters in Chicago.
You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. We'll have more of Mike Gray later on in this program. If you want to find out how you can get a discount on his book, The Death Game, Capital Punishment and the Luck of the Draw, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. And remember to ask about The Death Game. Tammy Krause is with the Institute for Justice and Peacebuilding, based in Virginia. She works with victims and defense teams in capital cases, focusing on what's known as restorative justice.
The traditional way of looking at crime is what laws have been broken, you know, who broke the laws, and what does that person deserve. And restorative justice shifts that thinking to say what harms have been caused and what are those? What are the needs of those people, and who's responsible to meet those needs? And so just by framing the questions, you can see the shift in terms of how you look at crime. Because not only the victims have been harmed by a crime, but they're the central role. And so it's really trying to bring victims into a more central role in a process within the judicial system. And in our traditional judicial system, victims aren't a part of the process at all. And it's not trying to have the victims become the judge or the jury. It's really looking at the victim and saying, something horrible has happened to you. And let us hear what it is that has happened to you. How have you been harmed? And what can we as your community, and what can the person as the offender do to right that wrong? And so it's from restorative justice that I got very interested in looking at how does the judicial system actually formally deal with victims in serious acts of crime.
Krauss adds that victims' families don't often get the answers they need to begin the healing process, answers they would never get in the courtroom. Instead, the criminal justice system often forces them to just confront their own political and ethical views on the death penalty.
I think so often victims feel boxed because, first off, the judicial system doesn't give them any options. The only option that they're given is the death penalty. They don't have any say in anything other than this is what we're seeking in terms of justice. And of course, families want justice. And when the judicial system says, in the name of justice, this is what we're going for. And so then I think it does become like this fight, either you're for the death penalty or against the death penalty. And then it becomes a conversation that takes people onto a much higher moral ground. Are you going to be able to rise above, you know, kind of the inhumanity that was caused to your father or to your sister or to your loved one, you know, and take the higher moral ground? And I think that that's just, we put way too much expectation and weight on victims. I think if we reshaped the questions to ask the victims, what's most important to you? And what are your judicial needs? At some point, when you really address those questions, if the system really systematically looked at answering those questions, the death penalty becomes a moot point. It becomes immaterial to them almost. And the thing that we do to the benefit of the victims is we don't put them to this moral litmus test, you know, of are you good enough to not be in favor of the death penalty, or, you know, are you going to have to make the arguments for why you're in favor of it. I don't think we should ever have to put victims in that space. But I think that if we reshifted the questions and asking people what's most important to them, it really becomes something where they say, I don't think I really need that, although I think that he may deserve it, you know. But these other things are more important to me, which is getting acknowledgement from the defendant, having questions answered. What were my daughter's last words? Mm-hmm. How long was my father alive before you killed him? I mean, those are questions where we, you know, as a general audience, don't want to go near. We think that's really scary stuff. Why would you want to know the horror of those answers, you know? But the reality is that I've learned from victims that I've worked with is, you know what, there's nothing worse than their imagination. Because if they don't have the answers, every night they replay this, you know, the scenario out differently. And it always has different endings. And I've learned that that's much worse than not knowing the truth.
Restorative justice also allows for defendants to express a sense of remorse if they choose to do so.
I really believe that deep within each person, there is a need to actually take responsibility and acknowledge what has happened. Mm-hmm. And that need is oftentimes buried, you know, under shame, guilt, fear, pride, almost disbelief that they even did it, you know, justification. And so it really takes quality attorneys and people, experts that work with attorneys, to help kind of, you know, peel away those layers, you know, that a defendant of what could have gotten a person to the position in which they are, you know, charged with the crime of killing somebody. But I think that once you get through all of those layers and you really look at the defendant's needs, And that goes back to the whole restorative justice, you know, what, you know, harm has been caused and, you know, what are their needs. I think defendants have needs, too, that we need to look at. And I think when you ask that kind of question, what are your needs to the defendant, I think one of those is to acknowledge what happened and in some way to make amends. Some people, some defendants just aren't in a place where they can do that, whether they're either so mentally ill or they're so incapacitated in one way or another that they're not able to do that. But I think by and large, defendants really do want to do that, but they just don't know how. And they're not a part of a system that even encourages that type of thinking.
Krauss adds that she has experienced powerful moments of humanity through her work, notably the cases of murderers Chris Dean in Vermont and Carrie Stanner in California.
There's a couple that really stand out for me. One was a case in Vermont in which a mother, through a formal plea agreement in which the defendant met a lot of the mother's needs, had actually done a face-to-face meeting with a trained facilitator the day before he was sentenced. And they met for 4 hours and had it, you know, just a lot of, you know, a lot of passionate discussion about what had happened, and there were a lot of tears. And the next day at his sentencing hearing, Sheila Rockwell, the mother, gave her victim impact statement still. And as she stood to leave, Christine, the defendant, said in an audible tone, "I am so sorry." And as she walked past the bar to go back into the audience, Christine's wife, Diane, was, you know, sitting behind him. And as Sheila Rockwell went through the bar, Diane Dean held out her hand to Sheila Rockwell. This is the defendant's wife and the victim's mother holding hands. And they sat there holding hands for a couple minutes, and the court couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't do anything because these two women are holding hands. And finally, the judge just called for a recess just so that people could compose themselves. I mean, that when you allow there to be a relationship as formal as it needs to be, it's still allowing for that acknowledgement and for that humanity that normally doesn't happen within the court system. Another situation, which is in the Carrie Stanner case. Carrie Stanner is a man who is convicted of killing four women in California in Yosemite National Park. Mm-hmm. And one of the women, Joey Armstrong, her family worked very hard with the prosecution to work out a formal plea agreement, again, where Carrie Stanner agreed to meet all of these different needs that the family had. And at his sentencing hearing, the judge said, "Mr. Stanner, do you have anything you'd like to say to the court?" And Carrie Stanner started addressing the judge and was facing the judge. And about 30 seconds into talking, he all of a sudden turned and he faced the family. And he addressed them by name. He said, "I'm so sorry, Mrs. Armstrong. I'm so sorry, Michael." That was Joey's fiance, Michael Raffaele. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, he faced them the whole time. And just talk to them, saying, "I'm so sorry. I wish I could take this back. I wish Joey was here, but she's not. I wish I wasn't here, but I am." It just went on and on. And the thing that happened afterwards is that Joey's mom, Leslie, I mean, she has no love for this guy. Yeah. But all of a sudden, I mean, there was a part of her that said she really ached for him. And that she was glad that he addressed her. And it's that acknowledgement. It's that seeing the possibility of humanity in the other.
That was Tammy Krauss of the Institute for Justice and Peacebuilding. She spoke with Making Contact's Susanna Hines. There are times when a murder is so heinous, or the need to pin a murder on just about anyone is so politically necessary, that death sentences are rammed through the criminal justice system, says author Mike Gray. In his book, The Death Game, Gray cites numerous examples, such as the murder of Jeanine Nicarico in DuPage County, Illinois. In 1983, the 10-year-old girl was kidnapped from her home in the middle of the day, raped, sodomized, and bludgeoned to death. The county's chief prosecutor, Tim Knight, was committed to finding a suspect, in part because his boss was up for re-election that year. Early in the investigation, a detective in the DuPage County Sheriff's Department, John Sam, questioned Knight's attempts to make two Latinos, Rolando Cruz and Alex Hernandez, the Fall Guys. On flimsy evidence, Cruz and Hernandez were convicted and received death sentences in February 1985.
And this was a what's called in Chicago a heater case, you know, where, which is where the public's in full cry, and they've got to have the body, they got to have the killer now or else. And there was an election coming up, and so the prosecutor picked these two guys and said, you know, they seem to know something about it. And then he convinced himself not only did they know something about it, that they had done it, killed this little girl and raped her and sodomized her. And so this detective John Sam said, hey, this is nonsense. These guys had nothing to do with it. They're a couple of low-life mopes, and they're just, you know, like, they're trying to cash in on the reward money or something, but they have nothing to do with this. The real killer is still out there, and if you don't get him, he'll kill again. Well, they said, they pushed this guy. He's was one of the top cops, the highest conviction rate, highly regarded by everybody. They said, you're off the case. We're putting you on liquor violations. So he quit the force, the life, a job that he'd loved, and went to work, you know, selling used cars. And but through this whole thing, he had said, you know, the real killer's still out there. Well, it turns out he was right. And they had, not only was he out there, at the time of the murder, they had this guy in custody. If they had just looked in their own prison and checked his MO and seen that he had a reputation or a history of child snatching and kicking in doors, they would have known this is the man. But they were so blinded in their obsession to try to pin it on these other two guys, they totally ignored this. They let him go, and he went on to kill three other young women.
Expediency also led to the prosecution, and in this case, execution, of a man who might very well have been innocent of the murder, says Mike Gray. Gary Graham, later known as Shaka Sankofa, was sentenced to death for the 1981 murder of a man in a Safeway parking lot in Houston, Texas. His conviction was based on the testimony of one witness. Graham was executed by lethal injection on June 22, 2000, when George W. Bush, who had presided over more than 100 executions, was governor.
Gary Graham was a punk, not a nice guy. He's not someone you'd ever want to meet, especially not in a dark alley. I mean, he'd shot some people in a robbery and so forth, so he's not basically a sympathetic character. He just didn't happen to commit this particular murder. And but they didn't particularly care down there. Basically, Graham had, what happened was he was alleged to have shot this guy in the supermarket parking lot, and this incredibly brave woman saw him from her car, and in the dead of night, and she chased the killer across the parking lot in her car, and he looked directly at her for a split second, and she said, you know, I'll never forget the face, and so forth. So the police took her in to identify the guy the next night. They gave her 5 mug shots, and she had described the shooter as thin-faced, certain, you know, and no facial hair, et cetera, et cetera. None of the pictures matched her description except for one, Gary Graham, the guy that the police had apparently, they already assumed that he had done it, and they were just trying to give the witness a little bit of assistance, you know, by limiting her. And she said, that looks the most like him. Next night, they have her look at a lineup of 5 guys in the station house, and only one of these guys is one of the ones from the photographs, and that's Gary Graham. And she says, that's him. Then on the way home, she tells the police officer who's driving her, I recognized him from the photograph. Okay, now that's quite a leap, but in the case of by the time she had been questioned about this repeatedly, her resolve hardened and to the point where she's absolutely certain, unquestionably, this is it. Well, what nobody knew at the time, because his lawyer was a court-appointed attorney named Ron Mock. And Ron Mock was a notorious figure in Houston. He was a black lawyer, but he was one of the few. This is back in the 80s, okay? So Ron Mock was one of the very few black attorneys licensed to practice there. And he got all these death penalty cases. They didn't pay much because Texas doesn't give you a lot of money, or didn't at that time give barely anything for a defense. And the way that Mock was able to make his fortune, and he did make a fortune, he drove a Rolls Royce and owned a bunch of saloons in downtown Houston and so forth, was quite successful, but he did it on volume. All right. Now, if you're doing death penalty trials and you're making your money on terms of volume, what that means is you can't afford to call any witnesses on behalf of your client or anything else. You don't object to any of the prosecution maneuvers. You just grease the skids and get done with it as quickly as you could. And that's basically from the trial record, you see that's essentially what happened here. Ron Mock did not bother to call two other eyewitnesses, the checkout counter lady at Vaughn's supermarket, who watched this shooter for 30 minutes prior to the shooting, leaning against the wall, apparently waiting for someone. And she said the cat was a half a foot shorter than Gary Graham. The box boy, who walked right past this guy when he went out to collect the supermarket carts, he said the same thing. A half a foot shorter, doesn't look at all like Gary Graham, entirely different face. I looked right at him. I walked within 2 feet of him. And these witnesses were prevented from testifying by the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court said this information could have been presented in his original trial, because if Ron Mock had wanted to, he could have called these witnesses to the stand, but he didn't, and now it's too late.
Under the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, evidence that could have been, but was not, admitted at the original trial is inadmissible during appeals. Gray says that a viable alternative to the death penalty is life without parole.
Now, let's take Michigan, which has life without parole, does not have the death penalty, has since 1850s, has not had the death penalty. And they've had tremendous success with, and their crime rate certainly would stand up alongside Texas's crime rate. And the only way out of prison in Michigan, if you've got life without parole, the only way out is feet first. Nobody can touch that sentence. And I think the governor could commute it, but that's always the case. And the advantage that has for the victims of crime, the relatives, the mothers and fathers and so forth, is when the hammer comes down, in that case in Michigan, that's the end of it. This cat goes off to, I mean, they take him out of the room in handcuffs, and he begins serving his sentence of life without parole right then and there. You don't have to worry about what's going to, you know, happen 6 months from now or 6 years from now, or a host of appeals that try to save the guy from there. And the other interesting thing is, as far as the victims are concerned, when these last-minute desperate maneuvers take place, it's always about the killer. And I think that's very debilitating and kind of crushing to the victim's relatives, because you know, it should be the other way around. The victim should be the one remembered at that moment, but that's of course not the way life works.
Author Mike Gray. If you would like to find out how you can get a discount on his book, The Death Game, Capital Punishment and the Luck of the Draw, listen for our toll-free number in a moment. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at capital punishment. Thanks for listening. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerlow, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national advisor David Barsamian, and I'm managing producer Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.